Hi, everybody. My name is Beverly Burnett, and I am a very grateful recovering member of the Al-Anon family group. And I am so grateful to be here. This is not my first time to Seaside, but I am always, I'm as excited every time as I can be, possibly without just exploding, when I get a chance to come here. And sometimes I just come because I love you guys so much. I've been here to a couple of North Coast roundups where we were just attending the conference, and I've been to a few she things just for fun, and I just love what I feel when I come here. And this weekend has not been any different. So far, the speakers have given us a message of recovery and hope and the purity of the program that you aren't going to find anywhere else. I mean, it has been a perfect weekend so far. Anyhow, I am a member of Al-Anon. I've been a member since February 9th of 1981, and I did not intend to stay that long. I came here as a result of putting my 15 and a half year old son in a treatment center, and they suggested strongly that I go to Al-Anon, and I told them that I couldn't do that because I had a job and I worked. And they said, well, so do we. And if you want to come back here and see your son, you have to attend Al-Anon meetings. And I didn't realize how powerful that really was. I thought they were being a bit unreasonable. I was being a bit belligerent, which was a character defect of mine, and I didn't want her to be telling me what to do because I was paying most of the bill, and I just had this attitude, but I thought, well, if she's not going to let me come here and see him, I'll go to Al-Anon. And fortunately for me, the miracle happened by the time my son got out of treatment on March 8th of that year. I was going to probably by that time, and for the next 8 years, I attended anywhere from 8 to 11 meetings of Al-Anon and open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just found something here that is explained beautifully in one of the pages of our ODAP book, and it says, somewhere down deep inside, I knew I was home. And I knew that. I didn't know exactly how to put that into words. I'm not really good about doing that. I feel a lot of things, and I have a fairly decent vocabulary, but I am not gifted to be able to really sometimes explain exactly how I'm feeling. But that page, when I read that, it was like those were my words that I would put on my entry into Al-Anon, is that somewhere down deep inside, I knew I was home. And I want you to know, my son actually stayed on the front row. He said he was going to go up in the balcony and hide in a corner. But I'm not going to make him stand up, but he's absolutely adorable. And he's sitting right here on the front row with a black ball cap on. And I want you to know the most wonderful thing about my son. He was 32 years sober last Saturday. And that's that's really a miracle. That is such a miracle. That is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when we took him to his first AA meeting under duress, we had a little trouble getting there. First of all, we were in a little Mustang, and our other son was in the back seat with him. And we had told him that if he didn't get sober, he couldn't live in our home. And he does math for a living, and he calculated that up and decided it would be cheaper to be able to stay at home than it would be to have to move out with his buddies. And so he thought if he went to one AA meeting, he'd get me off his back. Well, it's not that easy. So we get in this little Mustang, and my other son are in the back seat, and they're tall boys. And they were tall back then, at 15 and 17 years old. And my husband, who is also sitting on the front row in a plaid shirt and has 32 years of sobriety, looked in the rearview mirror of the car, and he says, I am not going to Alcoholics Anonymous with a kid that's dressed like this. Now, Stephen had his hair kind of fried, And he had some earrings. Thank God tattoos were not a big deal, because he would have been like from the top to the bottom. All kinds of interesting characters would have been on his body. I know that. However, he was had a tequila t-shirt on and a Coors hat and holy jeans and titty shoes, and my husband decided it was an appropriate dress for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sitting in there saying, don't do anything, come on, let's be cute. You know, we're gonna get to a meeting, drive the car, everything. Well, my husband wasn't gonna have any of it, so he hopped out of the car and left us parked in the middle of FM 407. And he starts to go home, and my mind is thinking, he doesn't have enough sobriety to be there by himself. I need to watch him. So I decided to get out of the car, leaving the two boys in the back seat on a road, and go home and make sure that my husband would stay sober. And it was, anyhow, the window rolls down on the back seat, and the young, newly sober kid screamed out the window. He says, Mom, for God's sake, get in the car. We're going to be late for the meeting. Now, I had what alcoholics call a dilemma. I didn't know whether to go home and watch him or whether I should drive the car to an AA meeting, and sanity returned, and I got in the car and I took us to Alcoholics Anonymous and to Al-Anon. When we walked in the first, in the door that night, the young one walked in, and then my unsober son walked in afterwards, and Millie, my friend today, looked at him and said to me, oh my God, who is that? And I said, that's my son. That's our oldest son. And she says, Beverly, he's half dead. And she waved over a guy named Bobby, and she says, here, take care of him. He's Beverly's other son. And there was a little resistance there, and he kind of was trying to tell Millie he didn't want to work with kids anymore, that they didn't stay sober and yada yada. But apparently Millie had some power over Bobby, and then next thing I knew, I went for a cup of coffee, and I'm standing. There was a little space of wall between the Al-Anon door and the AA door, and I'm standing there, and I peeked into AA just to make sure that he didn't escape. And I got to watch the young one kind of nudge him and go like that, and I got to stand in the doorway when he stood up, and he said his name was Steve, and he was alcoholic. And my husband wasn't there for that. You know, alcoholism was still, the ism of the disease was alive and well in our family, and really it was a chaotic family, and it has taken years and years and years and 100 million meetings and thousands of conventions and everything to put us, you know, we were like Humpty Dumpty. We had fallen off the wall, and it's taken years for all of us to get put back together again. So he stood there that day, and I got to watch the miracle of a 12-step call, and I got to hear his first sober prayer, and it gave me a respect for Alcoholics Anonymous that I would not have gotten any other way. But to be able to hear him say, Bobby told me to tell you that I was grateful for this day of sobriety, and then the phone rang in the morning, and I'm thinking, what the heck is going on here? You know, doesn't he know how early it is? And it was Bobby telling him to be sure to get up and thank God for that day of sobriety, and that's how it went. And it impacted me so much, the power of this. And I thought, if there's that kind of power in Alcoholics Anonymous, there has got to be that kind of power in the rooms of Al-Anon, and there has been. A few things that I really need to tell you. My husband and I have been married to each other for 51 and a half years. We celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary on 11-11-11. And it was not planned, you know, some 50 years ago that was going to be a big deal. Our family gathered. There aren't many of us left. A lot of us have died of alcoholism. And those that are left and were in the area came, and all together there were 18 sober people sitting at the table at a little chicken restaurant, and we had a lot of fun. I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the recovery in my family. When Stephen and George were a year sober, they did a 12-step call on my sister's husband, and he has been consistently sober ever since. And my son, we used to throw kids out of our house because you know how we think, if it wasn't for them, they would be okay. I had that kind of a thought process, and we kept throwing kids out the front door knowing that they were a bad influence on these boys. And we lost our youngest son to alcoholism in February of 1993. And one of the kids that we were throwing out the door was one of the people that talked at Scott's memorial service. So you just never know. But I'm going to just tell you a little bit more. I've got three granddaughters. I have three golden retrievers, and on the 18th of May, all three of them will be registered service dogs. When I was 60 years old, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, which I'd always known I had, but somebody in the program put me through a battery of tests, and it became official. And it was an amazing moment for me because all through my life I had been called stupid. I wore dunce caps. I kneeled on beans. I had bad report cards, can't sit still, can't pay attention, knows that there's potential and all this stuff. And nobody knew what was wrong with me. And shortly after my 60th birthday, I got this packet in the mail that said I had an enormous IQ and 5% comprehension, and I had basically memorized my life. So what I do with my golden retrievers is I work in a program at the library, which has been temporarily put on the back burner, but the little kids that I was working with come to my house, and they're little dyslexic girls, and they read to my dogs. And it's very rewarding because to me, I think to myself, these little kids, they've known since they were like 5 years old that they've got this disability and they are not going to have to be humiliated by what's wrong for the rest of their life. And I'm happy and feel really grateful to be a part of that. And the dogs are just wonderful. They just lay there like they know what they're doing and listen to the story. So anyhow, I'm going to tell you about my life. It was all of the little details of my life. I was born in Chicago. That's why I don't sound like I'm a Texan. I've only lived in Texas 36 years, and the only word I've learned so far is y'all. I think I can say that my father really was alcoholic, although you know they're not supposed to say that you're alcoholic unless you really have proof, but I think I have proof. My dad came to live with me because he was dying of multiple myeloma. He came in 1988. And he was laying on his sofa in Santa Barbara, California, and he was dying. They had burned his esophagus with a radiation treatment on some vertebrae in the back of his neck. And, I'd call every day and say, Daddy, how you doing? And, he was from that old school. They'd say, just fine. I'm doing just fine. And so I thought my dad was doing fine. So a neighbor called me, and she said, Beverly, do you have any idea how bad off your dad is? And I said, no, I talk to him every day, and he says he's fine. And she says, well, he's not fine. And by that time, 1988, I had about 7 years in the program, and I knew that you do the next right thing. And so I started, putting things in place, making airline tickets, getting things in order, getting somebody to drive him to the airport, somebody to pick up his mail, all those things. And in less than 24 hours, we had my father in Texas. And then the same divine order happened when we were trying to find the oncologist that we needed for him, and everything fell into place. And one day we were sitting, we had come back from a radiation treatment, and he's sitting in his recliner, and I covered him up because he was always cold and handed him something to drink and a magazine with one of those frosty Caribbean drinks on it. And I said to him, oh my God, Daddy, doesn't that look good? And he said, Pigeon, ever since I've been on morphine, I have not wanted to drink. So I can tell you that I came from an alcoholic home. my father was a lot of fun. He was just a lot of fun, and I always enjoyed being around him. It just seemed that my mother made him edgy. And she, I did not really want to be around her. I liked better being around him. And he did all the fun stuff. And one of the things that they did was they started to build a boat in the next door neighbor's garage. And there was always a galvanized tub out there with ice blocks when you could get blocked ice. And we'd get to poke the ice and crack it up. And they'd throw the beer bottles in there. It was before aluminum cans. And they'd throw all that in there. And then they said, no kids in the garage. No kids can come in the garage. And so I always heard the laughter out there and their ha-ha and har-ha and out there. And I'm thinking, and you want me to go back in the house with her. And I want to be in the garage with them. And all that laughter and fun went on for a couple of years. And what I was eventually to find out is that they were having so much fun in the garage, they built the boat bigger than the doorway. And if you go to 2829 South St. Louis, probably today you will find a boat in the garage. So there was a lot of things that went on in that house, and I don't have to tell you. You know, if you read Survival to Recovery, the first 17 pages describe alcoholism in an alcoholic house, and I was raised up in a lot of that. And I watched my mom and dad fight, and, you know, I watched her jerk the sleeve right out of his shirt, and just nasty, mean, screaming, yelling, long periods of silence. One day I watched her take a hammer and just pound his wedding ring to a flat little thing. I saw things, you know, and I heard things, and I felt things that I had no control over, and so all I knew to do was just go find somewhere else to be. And so I was really good at that. So I did the survival part as far as alcoholism is concerned, and I found places where I could go. My father always brought home a paycheck. We always had food, clothing, and shelter, which I understand are the spiritual needs that all of us at some level have and were to be grateful for. And I began to see that no matter how bad the alcoholism ever was, as I look back over my life, we were always taken care of. And today, that is the greatest comfort that I know. I am always cared for. And I know that so down deep inside of me, and I have no words to tell you about it, except I know I am in divine grace. I don't know whether I'm not trying to make any of you feel bad, but I am absolutely God's favorite child. So anyhow, there was all this stuff going on, and when I was 7, my sister was born, and I didn't have words to put to that, so I was jealous. I felt competition. I was having a hard time getting any kind of attention in that house. The focus was entirely on, you know, the fighting and my dad and making up and, you know, and it's going to be different and all of those things that go on in an alcoholic home. And they put a bassinet in the living room, and it was pink and cute, and they brought this little baby home from the hospital, and there were presents, and people were going ooh, ah, and all that. And I am beside myself with fear and jealousy and a feeling of competitiveness, and I don't know how to handle that. I don't know how to tell anybody how I feel, because I don't know how I feel until I got to you. And so the next thing for me is that as soon as it was possible, I just terrorized her for the rest of her life. Anything I could do to relieve, I guess, the frustration, the fear, the anger, or whatever it is. I mean, I pulled her braids, I smacked her, I slammed her fingers in doors and drawers. I did everything I could to hurt her because I had these feelings inside of me that I didn't know what to do with. 3 years later, my brother came along, and it did not bother me. It was just another, you know, it was just another person in the family. At one point, my mom decided that it was too difficult to live in Chicago. There was too much drinking going on. My dad had an alcoholic brother, and it's the kind that you envision. My Uncle Jimmy looked like what we think alcoholism looks like on the outside. He had the dirty trench coat. He had the unshaven beard, the greasy, dirty hair that hadn't been combed or cut for a long time. He had nicotine-stained fingers, and his nails were brown, and they were so long they would grow over the tops of his fingers. And eventually somebody from 26th Street would call my dad and say, "Jimmy's really bad. You guys need to do something with him." So my dad would go down to 26th Street, gather up this dirty, drunken man, and he'd bring him home, and my mother literally would Clorox him. They put him, I can remember the smell as if it was yesterday, they put him in there and they would Clorox him and cut his nails and cut his hair, and then they would take him to the VA hospital. And they didn't do this once or twice. They did it over and over and over until one day my mother said, "I don't care if he dies out there or rots in a doorway, don't ever bring him here again." And I didn't know until I got to you that that's what happens to alcoholics. You know, I would look at my uncle and I think, "Oh, that was so sad," and he'd bring me a little bag of potato chips and I'm a cheap date, and I think, "God, he's a great guy," you know. So I didn't know. I was so overexposed to alcoholism that I didn't know what it was until I came to you and sat here and listened to the stories of the alcoholics and understood that I didn't know any other way to live because that's the only way that I ever knew. So we moved out into the suburbs and it was going to get better. So it was my introduction to a geographic. I thought if you just move, if you go somewhere, if you take a vacation, it's going to get better. But what I learned is that it didn't get better because we had alcoholism and it was progressing in that house. And when we got to Westmont, you know, she had the house that she thought she wanted and the fighting started again and it brought to me a great deal of confusion. She said if we moved to Westmont, it was going to get better and it wasn't better. It got worse. My father was the post commander of the VFW, and there was more drinking and partying and out of control things, and it was just the progression. If you were to watch the family and our little family on a video screen, you know, little clippets and snippets a week at a time, you could clearly see how the family was going down, you know, with the disease. Finally, my dad had a chance to move to Utah. And it was going to be really like the ultimate. It was really going to be the answer because we were going to get really far away. But what we didn't know is that all this fighting and all this stuff was going to continue on because there was a progression to the disease of alcoholism. And I had found myself a little nest of friends and places to go. And I had built up a security so that I could get out of that house as often as I needed to. And I would be gone, you know, back when I was a kid, they didn't worry about, you know, putting kids out. Actually, they would throw us out the door after breakfast and say, don't come back until supper. And they didn't care where we were. They didn't care just as long as you were home at 5 o'clock to set the table and eat. And we were always safe. We played in a pack and I was a real high energy kid. I still am. I really had a fun childhood as long as I was outside of that house. I mean, I really, really had a lot of fun as a kid. We came up in the early part of rock and roll and Bill Haley and all that, and it was, you know, we had a youth center and a place to go, and for the most part, as long as I was not in that house, I was, you know, I was really pretty content. So we moved to Utah in my senior year, and it was a devastating blow to me. It was just, I didn't know what to do. I had no friends. I had nowhere to go. My mom and dad were fighting unbelievably. She thought it was really going to be better. He met the train drunk, and all of this stuff went on again. And so eventually, I went to two high schools that year, and you know it was difficult because I looked like American Bandstand in Chicago, and you know the way all that dress went down, and we moved to Utah, and they were Mormons, and they dressed like that, and it was different. It was a whole different culture. It was a whole different religious thing. Then I was raised up in my aunt's church. My mom said to her one day, take her to church. I was 4 years old, and I ended up going through this church with my aunt and going through all the ceremonial things. But anyhow, when my husband and I went to get married, I was not granted the privilege to do that because he had been married in another church. And so I just threw it all away. I just threw it all away. I no God, no church, no nothing, just threw it all away. But going back to Utah, when I turned 18, my dad took me and got me a job where he worked. It was a huge place. And one day, I'm not sure how long I was there, this incredibly gorgeous guy walks in, and he's got a crew cut and a duck tail. And I thought, oh my God, I didn't know anything about him, but that was mine. I mean, I hadn't seen a crew cut and a duck tail in over a year, and I was like, whoa, that is mine. And he smoked, and he could do all those little foxy things with cigarettes that make him so attractive. And he had this kind of a swagger when he walked, you know, the smart-ass swagger that they have. I am addicted to that. You don't give me chocolate, don't do just one alcoholic with a cocky attitude, and I am addicted. So he had the cocky attitude and the walk and the haircut and the job, and he was older, and I was just like, I fell in love in my little office, you know, and I thought, wow. And well, they told me that they had all just been to his wedding and that he had been married about 6 months and there was problems, and that sometimes he was sleeping in his office on a cot and his clothes were hanging on a pipe, and I would think, whoa. if that was mine, if he's mine, I could make him happy. You know, and so then he would be back, and then there was like that. Now, if you were normal, and if you were raised up in a normal house, you would clearly know that any guy after 6 months who was sleeping in his office on a cot with his clothes hanging on a pipe, there was something wrong. But not me. I'm thinking to myself, I can fix him. So the drama went, I love drama. I was addicted to drama for a long time, I'll bet it took me 20 years in recovery to not get that adrenaline rush when things were going bad. And if they weren't going bad, I could get in there and stir the pot and make them bad so that I could get my hair on fire and start the gossip, and he did and she did. Oh my God, I loved it. And all of a sudden one day, after a lot of years of prayer and meditation and reading and inventories and sponsors and everything else, I woke up one day and realized that that was no longer the way I wanted to live. And I strive now to live in some kind of peace. And it's not always easy, but I've created a place where I can bring that about in my little house. And I concentrate on that because that's where I want to be. I don't want to live in that chaos anymore. But I loved, oh my God, that was my drink of choice, was a lot of chaos. And, you know, and this was, he was perfect. He was just perfect for all the craziness inside of me. And a whole period of time goes by, and one day he came up to me and he says, I'm officially separated from my wife and I'd like to take you out on a date. And I was so thrilled. Oh my God. He came to the house on Friday, and probably in the year and a week that we dated, it might have been the only time he actually showed up on time. He definitely had alcoholism, and he showed up, and he was sober, I think, and my dad took him in the kitchen, and I think alcoholics can kind of spot each other, and they, some little mark, I don't know where it's at, but they see it, you guys all see it. Anyhow, they got half in the bag by the time we ever went out to eat, and he spent his paycheck on me, you know, and I thought that was pretty cool, and you know, it was just crazy. He had an Oldsmobile convertible. It was as long as this room. And, you know, now, a year and a week later, when we were going to get married, he sold the Oldsmobile because he told my father he couldn't afford me and the car. So we got a Volkswagen. But we ended up getting married, went on a little two-day honeymoon, and I just figured we were going to live happily ever after. And there was, I had no idea what I had gotten myself into. None. I had no idea, because during that year and a week that we dated, he missed dates, and I always took that so personal. I thought I was too fat, or maybe my mom said something, or maybe I needed to color my hair, or, you know, so I'd put a little peroxide on it, and it was really dark brown, and it'd turn orange, and, you know, blondes have more fun, and I'd starve myself. Back then, you could starve yourself for 2 or 3 days and lose 15 pounds, and, you know, and so you get the tight pedal pushers, and, you know, I was trying to do something on the outside to fix what was wrong with me on the inside. And there is no fixing that until I got here and got acquainted with the steps and found my relationship with the God of my understanding. And so we got married, and well, what would happen is he would call me the next day after he didn't show up, and he would say to me, Beverly, I am so sorry I didn't pick you up. I don't know what happened. I just went to the keg for one beer, and the next thing I knew they were locking up. And they were throwing us out. Well, you taught me, and then he would say, and I'll never do it again, I promise, I promise. That went on for the next 21 years, but you know what, I never lost hope. I never lost hope that maybe this time it was really going to be different. Maybe this time he would come home sober at 5 o'clock. Maybe this time he would be nice to me. Maybe this time he wouldn't yell at me. I always would think to myself, maybe this time, maybe this time. So I had all that going on. And so we get married and we come back and on Monday and we go to work, and he didn't come home from work. And I called him and I said, dinner's ready. And he goes, I'll be there in a few minutes. And about 20 minutes later, I called him again and I said, dinner's ready. And he goes, I'll be there in a few minutes. And then I called the third or the fourth time, and by that time it had changed completely. And he says, I will be there when I get there, and don't call me again. And I mean, I'm married to him, what, 48 hours, something like that. And I felt something inside of me. And I know today it was my soul that said, oh no, not again. But I didn't know not again from what. And I got pregnant on that honeymoon. I had birth control pills, did not know I was supposed to take them. And as a result of that, we have Precious. And, you know, I had no idea how to take care of a child. And all I did is when they laid that baby on my chest, I was so grateful that he was whole. And he was not, it was during the time of the thalidomide stuff, you know, and I got myself, I was looking at Look magazine and Life, and they were showing all these deformed babies, and I was so scared that maybe something would be wrong with my child. And when they put this perfect baby on my chest, I looked and I thought, oh dear God, I hope I know how to take care of you. Because I had no idea how to take care of that little boy. Thank God my sister helped me along. She loved children. I didn't know anything much about kids. And so anyhow, time went on. The alcoholism was progressing. He was not coming home. The fighting started. I thought that when he called me a tree, he meant that I was a tree. And thank God for our Al-Anon literature that explained to me that that's not true. That's the language of active alcoholism. But it had an effect on me. All of that fighting and the diminishing and everything had a great effect on me. And it was bad enough that I was raised up in alcoholism, and now it was continuing, and there was really not much left in my soul. And our second child was born exactly 2 years later, and he went up the corporate ladder and had promotions in spite of the alcoholism. And anyhow, ended up in Texas in 1978. And what I didn't know then when we got to Texas is that both of my sons, who were probably 13 or 14 and 16, their birthdays are in August, so they were just approaching birthdays, that they were full-blown alcoholics by the time we got to Sparta, from Sparta to Texas. And all of the chaos that goes along with having teenage alcoholism was happening in my house, and I kept saying, oh, they're just kids, oh, they're just boys, oh, that's what kids do. And, you know, call it denial, call it survival, call it whatever you want, but, you know, they were chopping the tops off of his golf clubs, selling them for bongs, and taking the screws off the ceiling fans, and they had a little set of Sidekick dishes, which I still have today, that had little burn holes on them, and they said that was from popcorn. And they stopped eating real food, and they were eating pretty much potato chips and picante sauce. I would go to work at 8 o'clock. They would bring the whole night stocking crew in from the Tom Thumb, and God knows what went on in my house during that time, except later when he got sober, he divulged in one of his early talks that they used to come there and get high and drink and get the cat stoned, and I'm thinking, oh my God, oh my God. One day they brought in a bag of seeds, and they said, will you help us with a mystery project from school? And so I helped them with that, because they had kind of excluded me out of their life, and I thought, anything I can do to be a part of their life. And you know, I'm going, where did that go? And the young one would say, I don't know, you better ask Steve. And so I'd ask Steve, and he'd go, I don't know. And finally, as this was going on, and you know, I can't think straight, I don't know whether I've turned off the stove. I'd go out the door, and I didn't know whether I pulled the garage door down. There were things floating in my washing machine that were unidentifiable, and I would go to one of them, they'd go, I don't know what that is. And, you know, I don't know became the standard answer. And what I know today is that they were stoned and drunk most of the time, and I don't know. That was true. I don't know. You know, but back then, I thought, they got to know. They got to know. But they don't know. They don't know. But not when they would go, I don't know. I could feel myself go nuts with that answer. I mean, I could feel it. It was all I could do. I mean, I would go crazy. I had a white hot temper back then, and it would go from zero to out of control. But for the grace of God, I'm not sitting in a prison somewhere, you know, for just beating the crap out of the kids someday or whatever else I was capable of. And I made a total fool of myself in a parking lot at an AA convention in April of 2000. And after that, I called my sponsor and I says, I can't do this anymore. I cannot make a public display of myself like that again at an AA convention, really. And she helped me get through an inventory, and we got all the way to the bottom of that. And a couple of days later, after, I felt such a relief, and I thought, wow, now I know why I get so angry. Now I know what triggers me, and I get so out of control. And about 3 days later, I'm in Walmart, and I'm in the quick checkout line, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And all of a sudden, one of the cashiers came along, and she takes the guy behind me, and she goes, come with me, and I'll check you out down there. And I'll tell you what, I went nuts. I'm thinking, he's behind me, she's taking him to a special checkout counter, and I've been standing here with my arms full, and oh my God, I was angry. I got so angry that they ended up checking out my groceries, and I stomped out of the store so justified in my rage that I forgot my groceries, and the very lady that I was angry at comes out with all my sacks of groceries and says, Mrs. Burnett, I think you left these. And so I called my sponsor back and I said, you know, I really thought we had gotten to the end of this anger thing. And I says, I just had another breakdown in Walmart and it's only been 3 days. And she said, okay, tell me what happened. So I tell her the whole thing about the guy in the back and I'm first in line and everything else. And she goes, no, Beverly, it's not the same thing. She said, you just weren't getting your way. So now when I start to feel like that, I have to ask myself a lot of times out loud so I can hear my thoughts and say, you know, why are you getting upset? Well, because I'm not getting my way. And there's this little spoiled brat that lives inside of me that wants her way, you know. And so I have to talk myself down. You're not getting your way. You're not getting your way. Do you want to look like, do you want to make a public display? Do you want to be the best example of Al-Anon that the people in Walmart might ever read? And I think to myself, you know, I don't know who's in Walmart that day. And they can walk by and think, oh my God, she's a member of my home group. So, you know, that kind of helps a lot. You know, it helps a lot to keep you under control. So anyhow, all of this stuff is going on and I am just crazy. And what I know is that the God that I had turned my back on loved me so much that he's sitting up in heaven and he's saying, oh my God, I got to do something with that girl. And so he sent me Margaret. Now, I never called Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I had heard the word. Actually, I'd heard the word. When my dad and his brother used to get real drunk, they used to say, we're going to just call A&A on you. And I didn't know what that was. You know, was that part of the VA? I didn't know. And then one time, one of my dear friends in Pennsylvania told me that her brother was alcoholic and that her sister-in-law was going to Al-Anon. And that was the only time I heard the word. And so I'm in all this pain and all this insanity. I grew the pot. I thought the cats ate it. It turned out they were drying it in a closet. And, you know, it's just, it was crazy at my house. It was really crazy. He had a bunch of little burn things hanging from the gear shift of his truck. And they always had an explanation for everything. So Margaret had been gone for about 3 days, and this is how I got here. Her son almost had to die for me to get the message to come to Al-Anon. And when Margaret came back to work, I says, where have you been? And she says, my son almost died from a combination of pills and alcohol over the weekend, and they had him in intensive care. And she says, he pulled through, but they took him up to a place in Denton called Westgate, and he's going to be in recovery for alcoholism. And I asked her what that looked like. You know, what had he been doing? And boy, for a moment, I had the privilege that God just pulled back that whole thing that was clouding my vision from the reality of my life. And she was telling me what her son had done to get to a place where he ended up almost dead at the Louisville Memorial Hospital. And for just a second, just a mega second, I could see the reality of my life. I could see what was going on with the boys. I saw them for what they really were. I saw all the food they were eating and the craziness and my husband's not home. Just for a second, I saw it. And then it was so painful to look at the reality of my life that I just shut the door on it. But I did one thing. I says, can I have the phone number for that place? And I got the phone number and I told my husband, I called him and I says, I'm gonna call Westgate and have him evaluate us. I says, perhaps Scott has a problem. And so I called him and they set up an appointment and all of us went there and they evaluated us and they said, we are really convinced somebody has alcoholism, but we don't know who. And Which really hurt my feelings because I'm like, I'm the one who has quit drinking to watch them and make sure that nothing terrible happens to them. And so I was really offended, but I'm afraid of angry people, so I didn't tell her that she made me angry. So I stomped out of there, and that was somewhere around the 20th of January of 1981. And on the 9th day of February, my son, my younger son, Scott, took something I knew I had been wearing, and I confronted him, chased him down to the bus stop in my pajamas, and he turned around and looked at me, and he goes, "Mother, you're embarrassing us. You know, go back in the house." He said, "You're making a fool of yourself at the bus stop." And I went back there, and I called in sick to work that day, and I saw myself and what I had become, you know, this out-of-control, raging, horrible person. I saw that, and I called in sick to work, and that was probably the first time in a long time I had told the truth. And a few minutes later, Scott called me from school, and he says, "If you come and get me, I will go for treatment for alcoholism." Now, if you're sitting here and you're new, pay attention to this. I came to Al-Anon because she told me if I didn't go, I couldn't see my son. My son went to treatment because the kid he had been robbing houses with that weekend was in the Denton County Jail, and Scott knew that it was only a matter of minutes before they found him and plucked him out of a class and he'd be sitting in the Denton County Jail, and treatment for alcoholism looked like a better out. And so it doesn't matter why you're here. Just stay around for a while until whatever happens. You know, this morning the message that we got about about alcoholism and the progression of the disease and the insanity and how after all those years of sobriety, it can still grab us. You know, I mean, what an incredibly powerful message we were given here this morning. And it doesn't matter, you know, how you got here. Just stay, you know, and start to do the things that everybody does. And so that's what began to happen for us. And I was going to all those Al-Anon meetings, and while we were in the treatment center, my husband got up one day and he got a desire chip, and I yelled at him all the way home that he embarrassed me in front of all of our new friends, that I had the youngest child in Alcoholics Anonymous in that treatment center, and now he stood up and said he was an alcoholic. What are they going to think of me? I had no idea that I didn't control it, couldn't cause it, you know, and can't cure it. I had none of that stuff. And so I started to go to Al-Anon. Shortly after I got there, somebody gave me, well, actually, my husband bought me an ODAP book, and somebody in the group signed it that night, and I began to read the pages. And as it's been talked about here this weekend, I can't remember what I read, but I read several meditation books every morning. And what, because of the dyslexia, what is easier for me to do is to find a common theme, a thread that runs through the meditations that day, and kind of just go with a thought, you know, and kind of put it and solidify it together by doing that. We started right off, you know, knowing that the fellowship was important, and we start running with people, you know, just like the speaker talked about this morning, you know, the importance of getting a pack and running with these guys and going everywhere. And they'd say, "Nell and Cleve are going to be at the Irving group, and Clancy's going to be at the Aquarius group, and Chuck's going to be at the Town North group." And Bobby used to call and say, "You guys be there at 6 o'clock." And I'd say, "Bobby, for God's sake, the meeting doesn't start to 8. You get out there and get a seat at 6 o'clock because I want you on the front row. You need to listen to this guy." And we had people who weren't afraid of hurting our feelings. They told us exactly what to do. "You're signed, you fill this out and put some money in the mail, and we're all going to the Canyon Conference. You sign and fill this out, and we're all going to the Brazos Riverside Conference." And the beds were awful, and the food was horrible. And I go back last year when we walked away in October from the Brazos Riverside Conference, we had been there 32 years in a row. And I just love it. I am from the class of 81. The class of 80 is still sober. Those of us who are still alive, you know, we're still, because I really feel like it was the community and the camaraderie and that feeling of being a part of something. I had been so isolated from life, you know, and it just was so comforting for me to be a part of something. And he gets sober, and oh my God, he just took off into the fifth dimension of recovery, just exactly the way the big book says. He's in Icky Paw and running around to young people's conferences, and he's going to the 24-hour club. And I had to have a little chat with his sponsor because the 24-hour club is in the worst place you can be in Dallas, and you see how gorgeous he is. Well, anyhow, I said to Bobby, "I do not want you taking Stephen to the 24-hour club at midnight. It's a bad neighborhood. And I'm going to tell you what, Bobby's finger grew that long, and he poked me in the chest, and he says, "And you want to know something? If he doesn't go to the 24-hour club at midnight, he's going to be a resident there if you're lucky." And I thought that really sobered me up. It was basically what he said is, mind your own business. He assigned me a sponsor. I started to work with a sponsor. Our youngest son did not stay sober. After about a year and a half, we ended up putting him on an airplane with a broken leg. He had fallen off of his wheelie bicycle drunk. And anyhow, we put him on an airplane with a backpack and sent him off. He just knew he couldn't stay sober because y'all were too old and too gray. And so we sent him off there, and he was with kids at a place called Pioneer House, and stayed up there for about 45 days and came back home. And it wasn't too long until he got, he was drinking and using again. And all along, I'm learning about enabling, and I'm learning about detaching, and I'm learning about how we place our children in the hands of God and offer them up and say, "He's yours." I did not know that that was not my child. I did not know these weren't my children. I didn't know that they were on loan to me, and that they were just precious gifts, and they could be taken, you know, or they could get sober. I had no idea. Their life belonged to God, and I learned how to pray and offer them up. So he came back from Pioneer House, and he didn't stay sober very long. I think he was using again by Thanksgiving. And all along, I'm learning all these lessons. And I really felt myself going, still in the fellowship, but really easing my way into the program, you know, to really be working the steps and talking to this sponsor that I was assigned to, write an inventory. I got stuck in my inventory, and I stuck it in a bottom drawer, and I'll tell you what, that is a really painful place to live for about 9 months, is to have a half inventory in your underwear drawer. It is really a painful, because I just ripped the scab off, you know, and I had this open wound. And finally in September, Sally said to me, "Whatever happened to that inventory you were supposed to be writing?" And I says, "It's in my underwear drawer." And I told her what happened, and she said, "I can't even imagine how much pain you've been in." So I finished that up and got that inventory written. And I was listening to all of the open AA talks and going to meetings. And in February, on Valentine's Day, my husband was out of town on a business trip, and the young guy came in, and he was really so out of his mind, and he started to call me names. And by that time, Bobby had begun to tell me that my home was a privilege, that living there was not, you know, you didn't deserve it. It was a privilege, and it was a sober home. His dad was sober. His mom's going to meetings. His brother's sober. He does not have a privilege to live in that home. I didn't get that. But that night when he walked in and he was so out of his mind and he was calling me names, and there punched a hole right up above the thermostat in the hallway, and I've got that hole there today. It's kind of barely patched over, but it reminds me that we have alcoholism, and it's a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual maintenance, that it could come back. And it was described this morning, it can come back. And I leave that there, you know, to remind me that this house suffers from alcoholism, and that's the end result of what can happen. And that night I handed him two paper bags from the grocery store, and I said, "You can come back here and live when you're sober." And that he was 17 and a half years old, and he never lived with us again. Time went on, and he's skyrocketed, you know, and I'm going to Al-Anon, and he came back from Lake Whitney. He had been out with Bob White and his sponsor, Bobby, and they had been to this convention, and I was sitting in my recliner facing the west window is in my kitchen, and the sun was just setting, and he walked in through the kitchen that day, and I saw him in the light, and I knew that he had been transformed. I could see something miraculous had happened to him. And I was just struck with the power of this program and how it could take a kid, you know, that was so dirty and so despondent and so laden with this alcoholism and bring in this beautiful, all of it. I mean, it was like anything. I can't put words to it. I'm not good, but I knew he was different. And I was sat there in such immense gratitude. And the amazing thing about that is I was starting to feel these things. I knew the power. I knew about how these things were changing our home and everything. And it didn't change us overnight. You know, certainly if you look in our kitchen window, you would not think to myself, oh, aren't they adorable? That's the Cleaver family. It's not like that, you know, but there is change. There is deep, deep change with inside of me. And that's what we're all about here, is this deep change that happens that we can't sometimes put words to. And time went on, and the young son moved off to Florida, and he knew that we loved him. Somehow or other, you told me to separate the disease from the child. Love the child, hate the disease. And I didn't know you could do that, because I had all this resentment about how he was behaving and the stolen items and all that. And I learned through you to separate that he was this precious little boy that I had given birth to, and I loved him so dearly. And he had this hideous illness that I was entitled to hate. I hated that illness. And I learned about that. And I learned about the detachment and learned about not enabling. And he went off to Florida, and he worked because he knew I was not going to be writing checks and sending money. He got married before they went down there. She did not like the enable word or the detach word, but she got over it and learned to live with it. And one day they called and said they were pregnant. And my first thought was, gee, many Christmas, how could they possibly bring a child into this progressed illness? And our granddaughter, Sarah, was born in May of 1988. In October of 1988, my son went into the hospital sick with what we thought was bronchitis or pneumonia. And 10 days later, he called and he said that he was in full-blown AIDS and that they had given him a year to live. And his little girl was 6 months old when he was diagnosed. And I had my dad at that time, and I also was going to have to put one of my dogs to sleep. And you know, in the big book, or in the AA 12 and 12, I'm not sure where it's at, it talks about pain being the touchstone to spiritual growth. And in our serenity prayer, at the part we don't read, it says that hardship is the pathway to peace. And I am here to tell you that I grew, my spiritual life grew at that time more than it has ever grown before. I called my sponsor and I says, oh, wait till I tell you what's going on in my life and you tell me that God won't give me more than I can handle. And she said, what? And I says, my dad's dying of multiple myeloma. I got a call this morning that my son's dying of AIDS. And the veterinarian told me on Tuesday that I had to put the dog to sleep. And I said, and I don't believe you. I do not believe you. I said, that is more than I can handle. And she will admit to you today, she's not my sponsor today, but she'd admit to you today, she did not know where the words came from, because she said she really didn't know for sure whether God was going to be big enough to handle that. But she had to convince me that she knew it was going to be okay. And she said to me, Beverly, you have to believe me, it's going to be okay. And I said, you didn't even hear me. And she said, yeah, I heard you. What I want you to do is, she said, you write in a journal every day, right? And I said, yeah. What I want you to do is every day before you write in your journal, because I always started my page out with Dear God. And she said, what I want you to do before you write Dear God is to write down where you have seen the evidence of God that day. And I thought, she really hasn't heard me. But, you know, to spite her, the way I do everything, you know, my growth comes through spite. To spite her, I thought to myself, I am going to prove to her that she is wrong. And I want you to know that every day from that day, I looked, first of all, before I wrote Dear God, I looked for the evidence of God. And what I do want you to know is that God did not give me more than I could handle, because it was one day at a time. It was 1 hour at a time. And when I thought I couldn't do it anymore, my sponsor would say to me, Beverly, just look at your shoes and just say out loud so that crazy brain that's scaring the daylights out of you can hear you. Say really loud, everything is okay right now. And I did that day after day, sometimes hour after hour. I would look at my shoes wherever I was standing when I would feel that fear and that overwhelm and, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And what is it going to look like? And how do you lose a son? And what does it feel like? And what about my dad? And what about, you know, I'd get myself just crazy over all that. And I'd look down and I'd say, everything's okay right now. And I began to believe it. And everything was okay. Minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, month by month, year by year, everything was okay. And instead of living a year, my son lived 5 years. And I got to watch the progression of the disease of AIDS. And it took this incredibly gorgeous young man, tall, strong, and withered him down to just over 100 pounds. He couldn't walk, and it was very sad. And he died. My husband and I went into a horrible slump. It was really difficult for us to get through it. It was, we had never done that before. There's no rule book on how to lose a child, you know. What do you do? And we were taking our pain out on each other. And about 4 years afterwards, it was just so grim. In the middle of all that, we had started a business. In 1982, we started a business, and it was just he and I. So we're working together, we're sleeping together, we're living together, and we're crazy together. And thank God we were in the program with our work. And people would sometimes see our pain. They didn't see us as being angry. They saw us. They knew we were hurting. And somebody would come up and say, "Beverly, come on with me. Let's buy a cup of. I'll get you a cup of coffee." You know. And it would take me off and get me to a place where I'd be okay again and could come back. And you know, one day we'd gotten our first golden retriever, and I just thought, I can't live like this anymore. And I said, "God, please help me. Give me an answer here." And God said, "You know what? You put that dog in an apartment, you don't have a yard." And I thought, well, okay. So I guess I get to stay, and we stay here, and the dog has a yard. And along with that, you know, I made a commitment. You know, all along I had thought, till death do us part, you know, and I really wanted to keep that, but it was hard. And so slowly, love, the look of love and the way that love feels when you're married 51 years is certainly a whole lot different than when you're riding in a convertible when you're 19 years old. There's a level of commitment that grows over years, and some days we have really hard days and some days we don't. And time went on, and you know, and we healed, and we worked together, and my program grew, and the pain that I felt all those years grew me into a woman. You know, if I would have had a list of everything that I wanted and everything that I thought I needed, it would have been a lot of material junk. And what I have gotten was, I got me back. You know, I got me back. I got these three granddaughters, and I got to be a huge part of their life while they were young. Steve's two little girls were born in Houston, and God gave me a really fast car in 1988. Had no idea what an Acura Legend coupe could do, but I'm telling you what, it was quicker than American Airlines to get down to Houston. And I made a point of going down there. I think I went twice a month. I'd go on a Tuesday and stay till Thursday, and you know, sometimes they traveled. Then all of a sudden they moved up to the Pacific Northwest, and I was able to travel up there, you know, and babysit the kids while he and his wife went off on business trips. And so I was an intricate part of their life when they were growing up. And I was not the woman that raised those two boys. I was the woman that God had created. And in that time, I could be the precious grandmother, and I could be the kind of person. I could be kind and loving. And I remember one day, I didn't know that if you put bubble bath in a jet bathtub and turn the switch on, I didn't have a clue what happened. And I thought, holy crow, and the bubbles grew, and the bubbles grew, and we made helmets and hats and mustaches, and I ran down and got the camera, and it took 2 days for the bubbles to finally evaporate out of the bathtub. And I thought to myself, yes, this is what life is all about. This is how we have fun. I didn't know how to have fun. I did not know how to have fun. And the other little girl, she was a part of our life until last year. I had a really hard year last year. In January, I lost a sponsee to breast cancer, and it was very sudden and very confusing to me, and it really took a chunk out of me to have this happen. I mean, she was almost 20 years younger than me, and she was just gone. She was beautiful and vibrant, and she had almost 30 years in Al-Anon when she died, and it just took a chunk out of me. And then in March, there was a, you know how families are, and suddenly my oldest granddaughter and her mom walked out of my life, and I just don't know why. I don't know why, you know, I don't, and I grieved for a couple of months over that. I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat. But, you know, I knew that if I took the dogs for a walk, if I went to meetings, if I sat and read my books, even though I didn't want to, if I wrote a few things down in my journal, even though I didn't want to, if I did those things anyhow and talked to my sponsor, I would eventually begin to heal. And what I realized that it took almost a year to come out of that spot. My husband has a progressive disease, and it's often very difficult, and on both of us. And I, you know, all this stuff was coming down, and what I realized on the 1st of January is that I had gone into some kind of a spiritual darkness. And I didn't know I was there. I had no idea. I was going to meetings, talking to my sponsor, reading my stuff, you know, doing everything. But something inside of me had gone dark, and I didn't know it. And in the first week of January, second week of January, I traveled off to be a speaker at a conference on the East Coast. And I'm sitting in the audience, and I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to talk about? Because I suddenly was aware of the fact that my light had gone out and that there was nothing going on with me, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And the first speaker gave a really great pitch, just like we heard this morning, and it was like somebody took their little Bic and just lit it, and all of a sudden I felt myself come back. And it wasn't until I'd come back that I had the idea of how dark it had gone inside. And so we don't have control over that. It was not anything that I knew had happened to me, but it was really when I came out of it, I got scared, and I thought how easy it would have been for me to walk away from Al-Anon. And that's when I look back and I think, when they take these countdowns and you look around the room, the women, you know, and the men of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous, there's not a lot of us with 32 years and 25 years. And I wondered if their spark went out and they got tired or something happened and they just thought, what good is it all doing? I could have been there. But I knew, you know, to follow my feet and continue to be an active part of my own recovery and my own home group. I have little jobs there, you know, I sponsor girls, I'm working with my dogs, I walk 2 miles every day, I drive him crazy, still, you know, it's part of my job. It's part of my job description. You got to keep them on their toes. So all in all, what I know today is that I was talking to somebody not too long ago, last week, and they said, regardless of all of the events that are going on the outside of my life, the bottom line is that I feel happiness in every cell of my body, and I believe that that's what recovery is all about, is that I have found this inner peace. I have found whatever it is, you know, that we can't describe, that has that big question mark and exclamation, you know, what is this place? What are they? I found it. I can't put it into words, but I love Al-Anon and I love Alcoholics Anonymous for saving my son. And every morning on my little iPod, I wake up to Susan Boyle singing Amazing Grace. And all that I can think of is that God came through Margaret and saved a wretch like me. And I am so grateful. Thank you.